From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, reaction to President Obama's Islamic State strategy, anniversary of America's 9/11 terrorist attacks, Pistorius verdict in South Africa, plus the latest on the Ebola outbreak. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. U.S. intelligence says the Islamic State militant group has between 20,000 and 31,500 fighters on the ground in Iraq and Syria. A Central Intelligence Agency spokesman said Thursday this is much higher than the previous estimate of 10,000. He says the new estimate reflects stronger recruitment by the Islamic State group since June, following a success on the battlefield and the declaration, that is, of a caliphate in Iraq and Syria. Earlier Thursday, ministers from 10 Gulf and Arab nations say they are committed to joining the United States and destroying the Islamic State wherever it is, including Iraq and Syria. In a late Wednesday speech, President Obama spoke about the strategy for defeating the Islamic State and the need for help from other nations. But as VOA's Al Pessin reports from London, such coalitions are much easier to come by and hard to hold together.
President Obama made clear that a key part of his strategy involves what he called a broad coalition of partners. That effort began at the NATO summit last week when 10 countries committed to working together to defeat the militants in Iraq and Syria, and there will likely be more support among European governments and peoples for this Iraq campaign than there was for the last one, according to retired British Brigadier Ben Barry, now at the International Institute for Strategic Studies.
And I'm sure the meeting wouldn't have taken place if the heads of government of those countries weren't pretty confident that they were going to have political, public and media support for at least some limited action as part of this.
Public opinion polls reflect that, and France will host a meeting next week designed to further coordinate efforts and generate public support. But there's a limit to how far Europeans will go, according to Robin Simcox of the Henry Jackson Society.
Where there's probably less support is if ground troops are involved. But unfortunately, it may be ground troops that are needed to ultimately defeat ISIS.
In addition to the current airstrikes and aid drops, President Obama is sending 475 troops to Iraq to train and advise local forces and help share intelligence. And several allies will sell Iraq military equipment. But the president wants more countries involved.
American power can make a decisive difference, but we cannot do for Iraqis what they must do for themselves. Nor can we take the place of Arab partners in securing their region.
Robin Simcox says support from the region makes sense.
This isn't just an American problem, it's one that threatens especially the Middle East. So you would hope that Saudi Arabia, you'd hope that the UAE and Jordan and Turkey would come in support for the US on this issue.
But key Arab countries have differing views on how to fight the militants and on what should come next, says Kathleen McInnes of London's Chatham House.
This isn't just a question about defeating ISIS. It's also a question about what does the Middle East look like in the future? And that's where things are going to be much more tricky from the coalition perspective.
President Obama says this will be a long effort, possibly years long, and such campaigns usually have setbacks along the way, which will test his ability to keep the coalition he's building together and to keep public opinion behind it. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
Americans paused on Thursday to mark the 13th anniversary of the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks. Family and friends of those who died in the attacks gathered in New York, outside of Washington, and in western Pennsylvania, where terrorist hijacked planes crashed. In all, almost 3,000 people were killed. President Obama took part in one of the observances.
13 years after small and hateful minds conspired to break us, America stands tall and America stands proud. And guided by the values that sustain us, we will only grow stronger.
Mr. Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama took part in a moment of silence on the South Lawn of the White House to coincide with the time at which the first hijacked plane crashed in New York. Frank Salufo, director of the Homeland Security Policy Institute at George Washington University, told VOA's Victor Beatty it is somewhat depressing that at the 13th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks on America, the President of the United States is outlining his strategy to combat a new threat much like the one that existed before the 2001 attacks, but one difference, Salufo says, that today's threat is not the same.
The threat environment is significant. And if we're to believe the words of our adversaries, the most visible face right now being ISIS, there is warrant to be concerned. That said, our homeland security, our defenses, whether it's aviation, whether it's intelligence, whether it's information sharing between federal partners, as well as our federal, state, and local partners, that too is improved dramatically. So our defenses have improved, but unfortunately the threat has not diminished, or at least certainly is significant.
The rising power of disparate militant groups around the world represents the most complex terrorism danger since the Twin Towers were destroyed. The Deputy Commissioner of Intelligence Counterterrorism, John Miller, says it's layer upon layer upon layer, not all coming from the same place or ideology.
Sure. Firstly, John Miller is a friend and an excellent professional. Secondly, in terms of the threat today, it comes in various shapes, sizes, and forms, ranging from al-Qaeda, which is still in business, to its many affiliates, such as al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula in Yemen, or al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, which operates out of the Maghreb, to al-Shabaab in Somalia, to Boko Haram. So you do have a number of terrorist organizations that unfortunately are with us today, as well as obviously ISIS in Syria and Iraq and a whole witch's brew of terrorist organizations operating out of federally administered tribal areas of Pakistan and Afghanistan, such as notably the Haqqanis or Lashkar-e-Taiba. So the threat comes in various shapes and forms. The one thing I will say is that they hold in common is they do ascribe to jihadi ideology. So whereas al-Qaeda Central, that was run by Osama bin Laden, is not the same hierarchical organization it was on 9/11, unfortunately his ideology lives on. So I think a lot of people thought on May, after the Abbottabad raid, ding dong, the witch is dead. Well, the witch may be dead, but unfortunately a number of witches have come in his place.
What would you describe as success in the war against terrorism?
Obviously, we have had some successes against al-Qaeda and its senior leadership. But if there's one thing we've learned, it's that these terrorist organizations thrive on a safe haven. The more time they have, the more space they have to be able to plot, maneuver, and to ultimately execute attacks, doesn't play to our favor. So the more they're looking over their shoulder, the less time they're plotting and executing attacks. So if you look at all the hot spots that you're seeing emerge today, the other common denominator, in addition to the ideology, is that they're safe haven. They're given the opportunity to move. And these are in un- or under-governed spaces. And to me, it unfortunately demands that we need to continue to address these issues.
Frank Salufo is director of the Homeland Security Policy Institute at George Washington University. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
As nations in West Africa battle the Ebola outbreak that's killed nearly 2,300 people, the affected countries such as Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone are facing extra tough economic times because of the disease's impact. Sierra Leone, for instance, has cut its 2014 economic growth forecast because of its crippled business climate. Sierra Leone, along with Guinea and Liberia, are among the poorest countries in the region and are hardest hit by Ebola. Joe Abbas Bangura is CEO of the business trading firm A Call to Business, based in Freetown. He says the people in Sierra Leone are experiencing the negative economic impact through price hikes on basic commodities.
course, as you'd imagine, under the circumstances, there's already been, there've been price hikes. Some calculations put it at between 10 and 15% price hike since the beginning, since maybe 107 days since the Ebola was outbreak was first announced in the country. Between 10 and 15% increase has already taken place in the price of basic commodities like rice, oil, onions, just those basic things that people would need on a day-to-day basis. Prices have actually increased.
In an effort to stem the Ebola outbreak by restricting movements, a three-day government-imposed lockdown is scheduled to begin on September the 19th, but the impending lockdown appears to be contributing to the price hikes as some people stock up on food and necessities. Meantime, the International Monetary Fund on Thursday warned the Ebola epidemic requires a large-scale global intervention to control a crisis it says is ravaging the economies in the region. IMF spokesperson William Murray on projected economic growth for these countries.
Based on the latest information available, growth could decline by at least 3 to 3.5% in Liberia and Sierra Leone and by about 1.5% in Guinea.
The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has said it is committing $50 million to fight the Ebola outbreak. The funds will be distributed to UN agencies as well as NGOs and governments. Chris Elias is president of global development for the Gates Foundation. From his offices in Seattle, he spoke with VOA's Joe Capua about the scale of the epidemic.
The scope of the current Ebola epidemic is unprecedented. You know, we've had multiple outbreaks of Ebola since it was first identified in 1976, and while they've been had very high fatality rates, the numbers of people affected have been relatively low, and the outbreaks have been in relatively isolated rural communities. What's unique about this epidemic is that it's spread very quickly and very far. And so this is really an unprecedented scope and pace of outbreak, which is one of the reasons that we're making this type of contribution of $50 million to the Ebola response. This is the largest grant that we've ever made for a humanitarian crisis. We've responded to many other crises over the years, but nothing at this level of magnitude. And it reflects our recognition that this is the most serious and fast-moving epidemic of Ebola that the continent has seen.
Why make the decision now? Are you seeing something very alarming that you felt it was very important to step in at this moment to try to stem things?
We made our first investment in the Ebola response about 2 months ago in mid-July when we provided $1 million to UNICEF for their regional response in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. And at that time, you know, we thought it would be a more contained epidemic. But then really over the last 2 weeks, we started to hear from our partners in the UN system, as well as the U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, that this epidemic was starting to spread and move at a pace that we hadn't seen before. So we spent the last week assessing that, decided that this was a fast-moving epidemic and it was threatening a lot of other development gains in Africa and that we wanted to participate in the response along with everyone else.
So explain how the $50 million will be used.
One of the unique advantages of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is that we have significant flexibility and we can be nimble to apply our resources to complement others. So the first set of investments that we have already made, over $10 million, is to support the UN system and the CDC, those groups that are working closely with the governments in the affected countries to fuel the acute response to stopping the epidemic. A second wave of investments, which we'll make, I suspect, in the next week or so, will be driven at the country level to understand what the needs are and how our flexible funding could best be used. And also, and this is a good example of that type of investment, which we're already very engaged in, is in Nigeria. You know, in Nigeria, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has been working closely with the government of Nigeria for a long time on a range of issues, including the polio eradication effort. Because of the polio eradication collaboration, we have been supporting a number of emergency operation centers to strengthen the government of Nigeria's response to polio. When they had the small outbreak of Ebola in Lagos a month or so ago, we were able to very quickly repurpose some of our resources and staff that were already in country to help support the government of Nigeria in putting together the Emergency Response Center in Lagos for Ebola. We did that in conjunction with the Aliko Dangote Foundation, a private foundation in Nigeria. The third type of investment that we'll make is in research and development. And we will work with a range of public and private sector research and development partners to see if we can come up with better vaccines and treatments so that we can both address this outbreak and have tools that would help to prevent and to control future outbreaks on the continent.
I know you're very particular in which development programs you invest. Are there certain therapies or potential vaccines that you're looking at?
Joe, we're really just beginning to make that assessment. We had a couple of our team was in Geneva last week for a review that the World Health Organization convened to look at all of the different therapies and vaccines in the pipeline. And we're at the process of doing the scientific diligence to understand which of those would be the best ones to invest in. And again, we would invest in that together with the NIH and the CDC and the World Health Organization and other supporters of research and development.
That is Chris Elias. He's president of the Global Development for Gates Foundation. He was speaking with VOA's Joe DiCapua. International Criminal Court on Thursday issued an arrest warrant for Darfur rebel leader Abdallah Banda, accused in the deadly 2007 attack on African Union peacekeepers. Four others are wanted by the ICC for violating human rights in Darfur, including Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir. He's accused of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity for his alleged role in Darfur's violent ethnic conflict, which, according to the United Nations, has claimed 300,000 lives. The United States is reopening its embassy in the Central African Republic after a nearly two-year diplomatic absence. The decision comes as the UN begins new peacekeeping mission in that country, where the government struggles to function amid widespread violence following a March 2013 coup. The Oscar Pistorius trial was adjourned to Friday later today in South Africa after the judge Thokozile Masipa absolved the star runner of all murder charges but indicated he could still be found guilty of homicide.
He failed to take any step to avoid the resultant death. I am of the view that the accused acted too hastily and used excessive force. In the circumstances, it is clear that his conduct was negligent.
The Olympic sprinter known as the Blade Runner, who killed his girlfriend and model Reva Steenkamp at his home last year, said he thought she was an intruder and that's why he shot her. Avoiding the charge of premeditated murder would spare Pistorius a potential prison sentence of 25 years or more. If he is judged guilty of culpable homicide, he could face at least 5 years of prison time.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
United States joining the European Union and intensifying coordinated sanctions on Russia in response to its interference in Ukraine. A statement from President Obama calls Russia's actions illegal, and he reiterated the United States and its allies are prepared to impose mounting cost on Russia by deepening and broadening sanctions in Russia's financial, energy, and defense sectors. Even though Russia denies involvement in Ukraine, European leaders agreed to implement a package of economic sanctions. Maya Kochianchik is spokesperson for EU Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton.
In response, the European Union is deepening the measures in four areas where we already have measures in place since July. We are talking about access to capital markets, defense, sensitive technologies, and dual-use goods.
And Russian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Alexander Lukashevich is calling the new sanctions an unfriendly policy.
Уже на многих уровнях The Russian political leadership has already made it clear to politicians of various levels that we will take adequate measures and our response will be proportional to the damage which these sanctions cause to the economies of our state.
But the EU ambassadors say they may cancel some or all of those sanctions next month if they believe a peace plan in Ukraine is working. Meantime, that ceasefire is holding in the eastern part of Ukraine. And in this report, VOA senior correspondent Andrei Dineshnura speaks with former U.S. Ambassador Jack Matlock, a longtime expert on Russia, about the situation in Ukraine.
The ceasefire halts 5 months of fighting between Ukrainian government troops and pro-Russian separatists, who Western nations say are directly held by Russia, a charge denied by Moscow. Senior Russian officials, including Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, have recently stated there is no military intervention from Russia. But the last U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union, Jack Matlock, disagrees.
Obviously, they're intervening. I think they would say, look, you guys intervene wherever you want to. You even invade, like the United States invaded Iraq, which had not attacked it. And we're essentially using the same methods.
Some experts have indicated that Russian President Vladimir Putin wants more than just to gain influence in that region, that he eventually wants to annex eastern Ukraine, as he did Crimea. But Matlock says that would not be to Russia's advantage.
I don't think there is an intent to take it into adding to Russia. It would be a totally irrational intent. This is an economically depressed area. It's going to be a basket case for anybody who tries to help.
But Matlock says on many levels, including politically, economically, and emotionally, eastern Ukraine is very important to Moscow.
It is an area that for centuries was part of Russia and where, you know, the ethnicity, the connections, people, you know, have close relatives on both sides of the border. They once lived in one country. You can't erase the history and these human and historical and economic ties. This area is infinitely more important to Russia than it is to any of the NATO countries.
Several NATO members, such as the three Baltic states, have expressed fear that Russia might move aggressively against them. But Ambassador Matlock dismisses that notion.
They are members of NATO. They would be protected if they were attacked. They're not going to be attacked. It seems to me that nervousness is quite misplaced.
Matlock says in addition to major problems caused by the pro-Russian separatists backed by Moscow, the Ukrainian government faces important domestic issues as well.
The basic problems in Ukraine are internal because the country never was able to establish a real sense of what it meant to be Ukrainian. And each government they had, whether it came predominantly from the West or from the East, tried to dominate the other.
Ambassador Matlock says it is essential for all factions in Ukraine to work together in a unified way to tackle the country's problems, starting with the economy. Andrei Dineshnura, VOA News, Washington.
Visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Scientists at the U.S. Space Weather Prediction Service are on the alert for two back-to-back solar storms expected to pummel the Earth over the next several days. Experts say such strong storms are common, but two in quick succession are very rare. Solar storms are caused when explosions on the sun send magnetically charged solar particles into the Earth's magnetic field. Well, the experts are predicting some radio communications problems and maybe some problems with GPS. You know, that's global positioning systems. Well, they could be interrupted. They say don't expect any catastrophic interruptions, however. Former actor turned governor of the U.S. state of California, now acting again, is out campaigning. Arnold Schwarzenegger made a rare political appearance this week to promote California's fight against climate change and to unveil his official portrait as governor. During his tenure as California's governor, which ended 4 years ago, Schwarzenegger signed California's landmark 2006 global warming law. That paved the way for the state's cap-and-trade system for controlling greenhouse gas emissions as the worst polluters. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead. We hope you'll stay tuned. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Marty Curcius, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
This is Today in History. On September 12, 1846, two of the most celebrated poets of the Victorian era, Elizabeth Barrett and Robert Browning, were married. In 1919, Adolf Hitler joined the German Workers' Party, which eventually became the Nazi Party. On the same date in 1938, Hitler, by then the dictator of Germany, demanded autonomy for Germans living in the Sudetenland region of Czechoslovakia. Tensions that had long existed between the Czechs and the area's German-speaking minority were used to justify the German land grab. In 1940, four teenagers stumbled upon the ancient artwork of the Lascaux Cave. The 15,000-year-old paintings near Montignac in France are among the finest examples of art from the Upper Paleolithic period. In 1990, the two Germanies and the former occupying Four Powers nations signed a final settlement treaty, paving the way for German reunification. In 2001, in the aftermath of the terrorist attacks that shut down the nation's financial capital, badly damaged the Pentagon, and left thousands dead, the U.S. government blamed followers of Osama bin Laden for hijacking the four airliners involved in the tragedy. And on this date, in 2003, the world mourned the death of Johnny Cash. With a career that spanned five decades, Cash became one of the most popular and influential musicians in the world. His first hit, I Walk the Line, is still a jukebox standard.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time.
I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Barack Obama has laid out his strategy to degrade and ultimately destroy the terrorist group ISIL. The brutal offshoot of al-Qaeda has seized large portions of Iraq and Syria and now poses a threat not only to the Syrian and Iraqi people, but to the broader Middle East and beyond. President Obama announced the United States will lead a broad coalition of countries to eradicate ISIL in a campaign that will take time, but will succeed with a steady, relentless effort. The president stated that the U.S. will conduct a systematic campaign of airstrikes in Iraq, expanding beyond the humanitarian and protective missions already in place to hit ISIL targets as Iraqi forces increase the ground offensive in defense of the Iraqi people. ISIL forces in Syria, Mr. Obama said, can also be targeted.
I've made it clear that we will hunt down terrorists who threaten our country wherever they are. That means I will not hesitate to take action against ISIL in Syria as well as Iraq. This is a core principle of my presidency. If you threaten America, you will find no safe haven.
In addition, the United States will increase support to forces fighting on the ground in Iraq and Syria, including by sending an additional 475 American service members to Iraq to help Iraqi and Kurdish forces with training, intelligence, and equipment, and in Syria by ramping up military assistance to the Syrian opposition. Moreover, to prevent ISIL attacks, the U.S. will work with allies to redouble efforts to cut off the group's funding, improve intelligence, strengthen defenses, counter ISIL's warped ideology, and stem the flow of foreign fighters into and out of the Middle East. The United States will also continue to provide humanitarian assistance to innocent civilians who have been displaced by ISIL. President Obama said in each of the four parts of this strategy, the U.S. will be joined by a broad coalition of partners, and noted that many countries are already involved. Secretary of State John Kerry is traveling to the Middle East and Europe to enlist more partners in this fight, especially Arab nations who can mobilize Sunni communities in Iraq and Syria to drive these terrorists from their lands. This is American leadership at its best, said President Obama. We stand with people who fight for their own freedom, and we rally other nations on behalf of our common security and common humanity.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.